Good morning, everyone, and welcome. It's August 12th, 2020, and this is an informational hearing of the House K-12 Education Finance Committee for the public and for members. This is informational only. We have no legislation before us, and we will be taking testimony from the commissioner and others from the Minnesota Department of Education on the plans that they have announced on school reopening. This is part of our oversight authority as the legislative branch, as well as an opportunity for the administration to give more background to committee members and for the public who are present today or may weigh in later to better understand the rationale and the data behind the plans that have been announced to date. We will be going through the executive order from Governor Walz, MDE's Safe Schools Plan, at which point after the presentation on the Safe Schools Plan, we'll allow for questions from committee members. Then there'll be a discussion of the federal funding that will be distributed to schools and school districts and charter schools across the state. We'll again allow for questioning at that time. To facilitate the public's understanding of which committee members are present today, I'll ask Ms. Sunderland to read the roll, please.
Representative Dabney.
Present.
Representative Sandsted.
Present.
Representative Kreisha.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative DeMith.
Present.
Representative Detmer. Representative Detmer, I know we were having issues with his mic. Representative Edelson.
Present.
Representative Erickson.
Present. And I'll go check on Representative Detmer. He's just around the corner for me.
Oh, thank you very much. Representative Hewitt.
Present.
Representative Jurgens.
Present.
Representative Katiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative Kanesh Padin.
Present.
Representative Marquardt.
Present.
Representative Murphy.
Present.
Representative Nornes.
Present.
Representative Pryor.
Present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Sandel.
Present.
Representative Joachim.
Present.
And coming back to Representative Detmer. I'll go ahead and leave that blank for now.
All right, thank you very much, Ms. Sunderland. Members, we now want to transition to a presentation by Commissioner Ricker from the Department of Education, as well as Deputy Commissioner Mueller. In addition, available for questions after the presentation, also present on the call is Darren Corte, Assistant Commissioner from the Department of Education, Bobby Burnham, Assistant Commissioner as well, Adosha Uni, the Legislative Director for the Department of Education, Chris Ehrsman, the Director of Infectious Disease Epidemiology, Prevention and Control Division of the Minnesota Department of Health, Kristen Ackert, who's the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Health, and Denise Anderson, the Finance Officer for the Department of Education. We'll start with the first two sections of the presentation from the Commissioner and Deputy Commissioner, and then pause for questions from members. Commissioner, welcome back to the committee. Please proceed. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much, Representative Dabney. Thank you, committee. It is great to see all of you again. Thanks for welcoming us back, and thank you to my team, my colleagues here with me as well today. We are going to share a PowerPoint presentation with you right now to pull up the details of Executive Order 20-82, which was the executive order Governor Walz signed for our safe learning plan. And we'll begin, we'll walk through our safe learning plan with you, and then we'll walk through the executive order, and then we'll walk through the safe learning plan with you. And to your point, then we'll pause for questions, unless you want us to do otherwise.
Commissioner?
So, starting. Yes.
Commissioner, if I could ask you to get a little closer to your microphone.
Yes.
I know I'm having some significant trouble hearing you, and thank you very much.
Of course. My apologies. Thanks for letting me know right away. Fantastic. So we'll start with the first slide of the executive order, 2082. And after the safe learning plan, then we will go to questions, unless you'd like us to do otherwise. So starting with Executive Order 2082, Megan, we can go to the next slide. The first thing we do is establishing and changing learning models to talk about for this upcoming school year, the 2020-2021 school year. First, there's an expectation that a learning model will be established. As we talk about the safe learning plan, we'll talk about how we localized the approach to establishing that learning model. But this really is grounded in the guidance we gave in June, where we asked all schools to prepare an in-person learning model, a hybrid learning model, and a distance learning model for the 2021 school year, with anticipation that there could be school systems that experience all three learning models depending on the course of this pandemic. We also, in Executive Order 2082, stated that districts and charters must allow students and families to choose distance learning in their local public schools, regardless of what current learning model has been chosen for the school in aggregate. We also stated that schools can be more restrictive in their learning model than the equation that is provided with that localized approach of county-based data as well as the school health requirements. And additionally, as we stated in June, as we were talking about being prepared for three different learning models, a learning model may be more restrictive, may be required for an individual classroom or an individual building in a school system that has more than one building, again, because of the course of the pandemic in that community. And in June, we called that the scalpel approach, and we discussed that in the executive order as well. And then if a school needs to move to a more restrictive model, they do need to notify the Department of Education within 24 hours of implementation. Now, practically, we are probably going to know before that because the Department of Education and the Department of Health really have committed to walking alongside our school leaders as they determine the learning model that will be most successful and that will create safe and healthy learning conditions for students and staff. And then in the MDE commissioner under statute may still order a district or charter to dial back to a more restrictive model if the current model is not appropriate for the safe learning plan. So that's been named in the executive order as well. Megan, do you want to go? There you go. Thank you. We're also encouraging our school systems to utilize an incident command team. Many of our school systems already have these teams in place for a host of other reasons. Otherwise, they can form one for this specific purpose to direct what those dial back or dial forward decisions are going to be in the course of the school year. And we also have directed the Department of Health Commissioner to ensure school staff and students exposed to COVID-19 are tested promptly. And as commissioners of the Department of Education and the Department of Health, we will consult with one another to update guidance for in-person, hybrid, and distance learning for the 2020-21 school year. And then I will just
short bit of advertising. If you would like to get our updated guidance, we do have a way we can, you can use your email address to sign up. And anytime we update our guidance online, you'll get an email notification, and you can go and see the updated guidance as it's been posted. So we can make sure to share that with you in the chat, or we can send it to all of you after this meeting to make sure if you would like to see the guidance and you haven't already signed up, we can get you signed up. And then there is our expectation that all of our school systems' learning environments will be in compliance with public health guidelines. That is that safe and healthy learning environment that we are creating. And any school systems need to dial back from in-person learning models must continue to provide meals to students during the school day to the extent possible. As you recall from last spring, one of the amazing things our school systems did was they set up meal delivery programs in 2 days. And so we are asking our school systems to continue to think through what that meal delivery could look like if they do have to dial back, in the case that they do have to dial back. Thank you, Megan. And the next page. We do expect our school systems to post and communicate their plans to students and families. We say no later than 1 week. We know our school systems have been in touch with students and families throughout this pandemic, certainly throughout this summer, as they look into fall, as they shape their three models. We do expect this communication needs to be communicated both orally and written in languages spoken by families in that school system. And in practice, our school systems have been doing this, and we just wanted to name that in the executive order as an ongoing expectation. We need our school systems to also create contingency plans for distance learning and hybrid learning in the case of any dial back that is needed. And then to provide documentation of this contingency plan to their school communities through those communication pathways we talked about in the earlier paragraph. We also included a provision where MDE can review learning plans to see if they adequately address technology disparities in access and in learning. One of the things we heard last year during our emergency distance learning period was about a deep concern over access to both devices and connectivity. And this is an ongoing concern we heard from the community as well. And so we wanted to name that we are going to offer particular support in those situations because it was so prevalently named during the last experience of distance learning. And then any districts or charters who choose to dial back in-person instruction are directed to support communities disproportionately impacted by distance and hybrid learning. The distance learning experience from last spring, I know a number of our school communities, vast majority of them collected a lot of data on the disparities and the improvements they could make. A number of our school systems also worked with hybrid learning this summer to determine what the best hybrid learning model could be. We learned a lot from them. And so where appropriate, our school systems need to prioritize in-person learning and services to students from who have been disproportionately impacted by distance or hybrid learning. And then the ongoing expectation of ESSA consultation, that tribal consultation must continue and American Indian Education Aid programs must be part of all three plans, the in-person, the hybrid learning plan, and the distance learning plan. And next page, Megan. Thank you. So a number of school systems are actually able to maintain the calendar they already adopted, their school board already adopted. The executive order does state, though, for initial in-person and hybrid learning models, staff should report to their respective school buildings no later than 2 business days before the start of the year to prepare for students' return. And around staff resources and staff utilization, pursuant to labor laws, and there is an expectation to negotiate resources for those contract teachers and staff that in compliance with those labor agreements should be in wages, benefits, and some of the working conditions in all three of those scenarios. And consistent with labor agreements and human resource practices, our school systems must utilize available staff who are able to work during the 2020-21 school year to the extent possible, which is also identified in working from home, that districts and charter schools must provide accommodations to staff as required by those applicable laws and allow staff whose health is at risk or whose members of their household whose health is at risk to work at home to the extent possible. And we did provide 5 instructional days or 5 days of planning during this next school year to be counted as instructional days because we recognize that if a school system is moving from one learning model to the other, they may need time to shift to that learning model. Practically, they may need some time to hand out new bus routes. They may need time to move furniture. They may need time to shift their lesson plans from one learning model to be able to deliver them in another learning model. And so our school systems can use those 5 days as needed, as they see would be a good fit for their school community. If we get into the school year and somehow a school system does need more than 5 of those days, they can submit additional days to the Minnesota Department of Education for approval. And another provision, because of the flexibility needed in this scenario to address this pandemic in our schools, expenses for special education staff may be assigned to other work for distance or hybrid learning. And the next page. Thank you. Similar to, if you remember also, our school systems magnificently stood up care for school-aged children last spring. And by the end of the school year, our school systems were caring for approximately 7,000 students a day across the state of Minnesota in care settings. And so in this executive order, we address care as well. Districts and charters who dial back from in-person learning are asked to provide care for eligible children at no cost during the time those children would not be receiving instruction in the school building during regular school hours. For early childhood programs, when doing in-person learning, our school systems may run those early childhood programs pursuant to those public health guidelines that have been well established and that our school systems were working all summer to determine like how they would do so in their school buildings. And they may continue to charge their fees at their normal sliding scale. And if they're running their early childhood programs in other models, they may continue to charge fees. We also addressed scholarship income verification in that these COVID-19 relief funds do not count toward income verification to receive an early learning scholarship. And developmental screening needed to be addressed given the 3 scenarios that we were asking our school systems to prepare for. And so the early childhood in-person screening requirement that is in rule is waived, and the Department of Education will develop guidance on a parent tool, and the 30-day developmental screening statutory requirement has been extended to 90 days. Next slide, Megan. Thank you. Additionally, similar to last spring, during that second phase of distance learning, the Department of Education will establish a protocol for home visits by school staff things that cannot be provided during distance learning for additional sort of relationship building home visits. And very carefully, school systems in distance learning models may safely expand in-school activities and programming that cannot be provided via distance learning. If you recall, during the second phase of distance learning last spring, we worked alongside the Department of Health to very carefully open up our buildings for example, career and technical education end of course exams that needed to be in person. Perhaps they were hand-on exams. Perhaps they were industry credentials that needed that were demonstrations or competency-based. And so we worked with the Department of Health to create the protocols to allow for that in-person work. And bilingual SEALS testing was another example, and that any school system in a hybrid or distance learning model must allow for graduating seniors to safely complete any testing in their bilingual or multilingual SEALS that needs to be in person, a test that cannot be taken online. And now I get to hand it over to my partner at the Department of Education, our Deputy Commissioner, Dr. Heather Mueller, to discuss the safe learning plan details.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Deputy Commissioner Mueller, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Good afternoon or good morning, everyone. My name is Heather Mueller, and I am the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Education, and I appreciate having the opportunity to come and talk with you today with Commissioner Ricker. So we're going to walk you through a little bit of the learning plan, which I know you all are familiar with, but we'd like to just really combine the information around the Safe Learning Plan with our executive order, which dovetails into the pieces we're going to be talking about this in a little bit around GEARS, ESSER, and our CRF dollar request. And so, Megan, could you move the slide forward? Thank you. So in the work that we've been able to do in our partnership with the Department of Health is really be thoughtful about where it is we want to center our work as we're thinking about returning to school. And the first thing that we identified in a combination with the Department of Health, as well as with the governor and lieutenant governor, was first and foremost to prioritize the safety of our students, our staff, and our families. And so with that, we then began to scaffold what it would look like beyond that. If that started at the center, the things that we also need to be thinking about is the second thing is we'd like to prioritize in-person learning. So if we were to have a safe environment for our students and staff, then how are we also going to then have in-person learning? And what we recognized is if there's an instance based on the data that it looks as though we can have students in school, the place we would prioritize that first and foremost is with our youngest learners and with some of our students who are most in need, recognizing that the data that has come out that the Department of Health has shared around students between the ages of 0 to 10 years old and the data that's coming out of South Korea, as well as information of our between 15 and 19-year-old students, made us cognizant that we had to also be thoughtful about a differentiated approach to the health data that we're seeing, that we are gleaning, right? As COVID-19 is continuing to work its process and we're learning more information, then also thinking about recognizing the differences in the potential spread and being thoughtful about how is it that we can then prioritize our youngest learners. We also thought about ensuring that we support planning while permitting flexibility for districts. We know that one size does not necessarily fit all. We're cognizant of the fact that some of our school districts and charter schools in greater Minnesota might have a different look in our counties than it might be in the metro or in our surrounding areas. And so really being thoughtful about what is it that our districts and charter schools need and what are we seeing as it pertains to health. And then also taking into account the disease prevalence at the local level, and that was where we thought about the county data. And so that really began the path of, if this was what we were thinking about for our goals, what are the next appropriate steps? Megan, could you move the slide, please? Thank you. So in that partnership in health, it's really thinking through this in a couple of ways. First is that we're going to use data from counties to determine the base learning model for schools. That was our step one. And that's really one side of the equation. We're going to see the equation here in a minute. But really having a place to start and to give us some initial information as it says right there, a base. The second step was really thinking about then how are we going to share that data and a consultative process with public schools to engage them in education and in public health, to really be thinking about then what are some of the pieces we need to be thinking about on the other side of the equation. What do we need to have in place that if we were able to bring students into and staff into school buildings, what do we also need to make sure that we're able to ensure to mitigate the spread of the virus. And so with that, then we're developing a process around how we support schools and helping to make that decision in a consultative model. The third step in that then is then having that conversation as a school district and charter school leader with members of your school board, with members of your labor unions, with members of your community, with your families, to ensure that everyone has a sense of what does the data say, what do we have in the mitigating practices, and what are some of the other questions we would ask in that consultative process. It's that way it is not an isolated or solely based decision. But we also recognize the importance of having some type of local control, because that community and what that
school district or charter school is seeing within their community could be different than what we're seeing in that county data. And that is why we're having the consultation. And so we'll talk a little more about that. And then really just thinking about how it is you determine what is a best learning model to start. It isn't the learning model that's going to necessarily be forever. It is the learning model based on the data that we are going to start with. And then how are we going to, in step five, continue to progress monitor? And we'll talk a little more about that. So the equation that we've talked a little bit about is we're thinking about from the Department of Health, the total number of cases for the last 14 days divided by the county population per 10,000 residents really gets us our 14-day county level case rate per 10,000. And so when you look at that, those bands, can we cut forward, Megan? Thank you. The bands are as follows. And again, this is one side of what we're going to be looking at. Thinking about if you have between 0 and 9 cases per 10,000 county residents over a 14-day period, in-person learning for all students is an option in looking at that one side. If, as you go through the bands, you recognize that the more spread and positivity rates you have per 10,000 county residents, then the more restrictive the learning model recommendation and suggestion becomes, simply because we recognize that spread we also want to try to contain. And so as we are finding more ways to be able to mitigate that, that's one side that we need to be thoughtful of. And so if you have 50 plus cases per 10,000 over a 14-day period in your county residence, then you would have distance learning for all students. Now, this is the other part. So the county data is one side of the equation, something that we're thinking about per 10,000 county residents, and that serves as that base learning model. The other piece then that goes in with that consultation is as you are sitting down with members of the Department of Health and talking about, these are some of the other pieces that we have in place. We do have PPE for district, for direct support services for our students. We are able to build routines of hygiene and education practices. We can also are ensuring that we are cleaning high touch surfaces throughout the day, and this is how we're able to do that. We have a building level or district level COVID-19 program coordinator, and we are limiting non-essential visitors coming in. So in some ways, as you are able to demonstrate that you have some of these other pieces that are known mitigating factors to the spread of COVID, then that may be an opportunity to become less restrictive in your model. If you were not able to do any of these things, then more restrictive would be the recommendation simply because you don't have some of the other mitigating pieces in place. And so that is part of the conversation. It is not solely based on the county data, and it is not solely based on the requirements from based on health, but it is actually in tandem in also thinking about your community. We can move forward. Thank you. So really it's taking that ongoing evaluative framework and thinking about on an X and Y axis is really thinking about the increase in viral activity as well as increasing public school preparedness and capacity to implement the mitigation strategies and ways that we're able to do that. So as we're thinking then, as these questions are coming up, and as we are working with in this consultative model, then we're really thinking about how are we going to continue to assess this as we are opening up more schools, whether that's in an in-person model or in a hybrid model. And so some of the questions that then health will be partnering with our school districts on is the following: how many cases are there? Are new cases traceable to the school community, or are they somewhere else in a different exposure? Where are the cases occurring? Is there significant transmission in the surrounding community that likely impacts families and staff? And are we able to maintain our current learning model based on the staffing and really being thoughtful about that as well? So these are some additional questions we'll ask. We recognize, though, that is in and of itself cannot be a vacuum. And while we have amazing professionals in our leadership, in our school districts, and in our charter schools, we also know that it is always nice to have some support and some backing as you are working with your incident command team to really look through that data and make localized data-driven decisions. You also, we've also heard very loudly and clearly from our superintendents and charter school leaders and school board members that they'd like some additional support. And so with that, we are building regional support teams that are comprised of MDH and MDE staff members, as well as local public health officials to really help our district schools and our charter school leaders as they walk through the remainder of the year. This isn't just a support that's going to help start the beginning of the year. It is something that we are maintaining throughout the rest of the year, and we'll talk more about that. We're also investing $430 million in our schools, our face coverings for every student, educator, and staff member, and then a comprehensive COVID testing care plan, which were all pieces that we had heard consistently from our school districts and our charter schools, as well as our families and our community members, on pieces that they thought were incredibly important as we were coming back into a learning model in the fall. So the regional support teams are really built off of each of the nine service cooperatives. And in that team, we have really coalesced every single school district or charter school that's in a region. We'll have one to two service cooperative team members, two members of the State Department of Health, as well as a local public health official, and one person from the testing work group who is going to be helping to review data, answer any questions. If at any point in time there is a positive case in a school district or a charter school, that school leader then can immediately call our service cooperative representative who is on this regional support team, let them know that they have a positive case, and then give our superintendents and charter school leaders the opportunity to continue to lead in their school district and to, you know, develop communications and start to build that process of what that looks like when there is a positive case. And then our regional service cooperative contacts would then reach out to the rest of the support team members and say, we have a positive case. These are some of the things that some of the things we need to be doing? And we'll work through and help to solidify that, and then come back and have that conversation with the superintendent and charter school leader. But really helps to build a team structure around that. If there was a need, if it was a large enough outbreak, if there was a need for testing in that district or in that community, that would be something we would be able to support through the regional support team. If it really is just a singular case, and it would be either something that does not need to shut down a classroom then, or whatever that would look like, we would really help that school district or charter school leader think through their ability to communicate. And it really is trying to structure around efficient communication, so also that they aren't having to, as leaders in their districts and charter schools, having to reach out to a number of people in order to be able to get support and answers. And it also helps to not inundate the Department of Health with over 500 school districts and charter schools contacting them because of a possible outbreak or because of a positive case in their district. And so it really is meant to be a rapid response process with education staff and health consultants, as well as testing event planners. And I think we'll pause there because there are probably questions.
Thank you, Assistant Commissioner, for that. I am going to take the privilege of starting off the questioning. I've gotten some questions from districts in more populated areas of the state who are finding that the county level data is not the level of grain that they need in making decisions. They need something more localized, say zip code or census block data. Where would they be able to access data at that finer level than county level?
Representative Dabney, this is Commissioner Mary Catherine Ricker. And thank you, Representative Dabney. And we do have Chris Erisman on on the phone. I wonder if we could ask her to address where we get the county level data from and why that is our starting place.
Ms. Erisman, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and respond. Pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Representative Devine. My name is Chris Erisman. I'm the Director for the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division at the Department of Health. And we currently do have zip code data available on our website so that school districts do have access to that. And I know that there have been several inquiries about that, and we have reached out to those individuals and let them know where the data is and where they can access it.
All right. Thank you very much. Members, any questions?
Representative Detmer is finally connected, just to let everybody know.
Good to hear your voice, Representative.
Representative,
Representative Erickson, do you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I had a question for Commissioner Ricker. Will the students in special education have their IEPs restructured based on the model that the district or charter is going to use?
Assistant Commissioner Mueller?
Actually, I think it was it directed to me as commissioner?
Yeah, this is for the Commissioner Ricker.
No, that's okay. Nope.
Since she covered that section of the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Representative Erickson, thank you for asking. We did address the special education guidance for all three models in our guidance, actually beginning last June, for how our special education educators could address IEPs as well as make sure that they were adjusting any student supports that were needed. And Assistant Commissioner Darren Cordy, who really helped lead our special education team in creating that guidance, is also on the phone if he wants to address some of the guidance that or in some of the work we have been doing in that area. I'd welcome him to add that. To make sure that we are absolutely addressing accommodations in all three scenarios for our students with special needs.
Assistant Commissioner Corte, was that a handoff?
I believe so. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson. It's a great question. We have not required or told districts, recommended that districts and charter schools do whole-scale revisions of every student's IEP based on the learning model that they choose. However, we have suggested, and this is consistent with guidance provided by the Office of Special Education Programs at the U.S. Department of Education, we've suggested that they consult with the relevant members of their IEP team. So that could include the parents, it could include a teacher specifically, to determine what accommodations or additional services might be needed based upon the model that is being used by that district. Certainly a parent always has the opportunity to request an IEP team meeting, and in some cases it may be appropriate to pull that full IEP team together when making decisions about changing services. And of course, the other option that still remains available and is always available is the dispute resolution services that we offer if a parent believes that their child is not receiving the services that they're entitled to under their IEP or IDEA or state law.
Thank you. Representative Erickson, a follow up?
To the progress or lack of that special education students received during the distance learning time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, I believe you were muted there for the first part of your question. If you could please repeat it for me.
Representative Erickson.
Am I unmuted? Yes. Well, I'm wondering if you have heard from districts and charters in regard to the progress of special education students under distance learning.
Yes.
Mr. Corte?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Erickson, we have had several forums and discussions with not just special education directors, but also parents and families And there certainly have been cases where students may have experienced some lack of progress as a result of distance learning. And in those situations, our guidance is really clear that the district or charter school needs to do an analysis to determine through the IEP team if compensatory education services are required. And if they are, then to provide those. And of course, there's funding available for those services as well. And then again, if a parent feels like their child is entitled to compensatory education services, but the district is not providing them, they can go through one of those dispute resolution processes we have, which would be mediation, a facilitated IEP team meeting, complaint investigation, or a hearing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Yes, just one last question for Commissioner Ricker. So, Commissioner, have you and your team discussed any data that might be available for teachers, parents, mm-hmm. and even students to use as they begin the new school year? And what is it based on? And are you recommending or encouraging strongly that there be some kind of assessment so they all know where the child is? And then I hope that we can have a discussion later about ensuring that the MCAs are administered in the spring mm-hmm. so that we have that data. But to what extent have you heard any discussion about where students are going to start based on data that we have?
Just a small question, Commissioner.
Representative Dabney, thank you. And Representative Erickson, thank you very much for that question, because it's really a conversation we started last spring when we realized we were not in a position to share the MCAs with students because of the emergency distance learning model. And so our working expectation is that first we are going to be administering the Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments this spring. However, to your point about our schools wanting data right now and not waiting until next spring, we've both been in conversation with schools about the planning they have. The Deputy Commissioner and I just met with our assessment director yesterday about her scan of working alongside the data coordinators in districts for what they are going to be doing immediately, like NWEA. Additionally, in the superintendent conference this week, we are providing a presentation and some expertise on reimagining assessment and data practices to guide learning for all students during the pandemic. And we're going to continue to offer that support to our schools so that they can begin the school year assessing where the unfinished learning of our students is, and then addressing that in ways in all three of those models, of course, in-person, hybrid, and distance learning, if that's the model they need to choose.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Pryor. Thank you, Representative Erickson. Representative Pryor. Members, we do have a long list of questions, so if members could be brief in their questions, okay. And if respondents could be equally brief in their responses, it would be appreciated. Representative Pryor, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll be brief in my two questions. The first question, I think, is related to students that are mobile during the school year. And I know in any school year, that's a major issue and a major problem. And it seems like it'd be even easier to lose track of a child and not, and a family may not know how to connect with whatever their local school district is or whatever their learning is. So can someone speak to a little bit how we're gonna, make that safety net where students, even as they have to move during the school year, can still stay connected to what should be the best education for them.
Commissioner, I'll start with you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative. I very much appreciate that question. First, we have been working very closely, our division at the Department of Education, first working with all the McKinney-Vento liaisons out there for any of our students who have been experiencing homelessness or high mobility already. These are our experts in the field for how to address mobility and how to help support students if they do have to move from one district to another school system. And then we are absolutely taking what those requests for supports in the field that are needed and making sure that we are addressing them through whether it is our school climate division, whether it is through our school support division, to make sure that if there is an unprecedented level of student mobility that is being experienced, that we are responding in kind for school systems that do not have the same familiarity that other school systems may already have.
Representative Pryor.
Thank you. And a second area that I was I wanted to hear a little bit more about is certainly in the press, you hear a lot about other public health factors for the spread of the illness. And in addition to time and distance and masking, they also talk about ventilation and also the idea of, you know, eating seems to be more risky to spread than just sitting or walking and that kind of activity. So, is that something that schools are instructed to as part of their hybrid plan or part of their safety is to look at ventilation and also situations where students might be eating or not?
Commissioner?
Thank you, Representative. Yes, as our schools have spent the summer, in addition to those tape measures in the hallway and moving furniture and establishing perhaps plexiglass, we have been working very closely with the Department of Health for those other factors our school systems should be looking into, such as ventilation systems. That is one our schools have been paying particular attention to because of the research on the health of a ventilation system. And to your point, we have been providing additional guidance on other factors that are involved in keeping students safe or just creating safety and health. And so our schools have actually been responding. And for example, we have a school that has an agreement with their American Legion down the street to move their band practice to the American Legion because it's about five times the size of their band room. And so they're able to physically distance. They're able to create health protocol going in around hand washing and masking and that physical distancing, and then follow the guidance around band practice as well. So we're supporting our schools, pardon me, and they are actually coming up with some really creative solutions to both follow the guidance that is out there from our Department of Health and meet the needs of students at the same time.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Edelson.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Daphne. Commissioner, I'm wondering if we can just talk a little bit about the testing under the COVID testing care plan. I just have some questions in terms of like the functionality and how this is going to work in a district. So in reviewing the plans, it looks like the teacher is able to request a test and within 24 hours get that test. And then within 48 hours of that, you get the results from that test. And then it looks like we used a vendor in New Jersey, and I'm curious as to why we did that versus partnering with local Minnesota institutions. So that is one area, but then also just looking over it a little bit more, it looks like, sorry, I apologize, my dog and my son are right here. It looks like that the teachers would be able to go to a clinic in Minnesota and get testing. And I just want to, like, there's no cost to the teacher is what I want to make sure. And then is that first test required to go through that New Jersey vendor? So if you could just address that for me, that would be helpful. Thank you.
Commissioner, or who would be best for responding to that one?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Daphne. And Representative, so there are really, I hear two parts to your question. One is about that first saliva test that our educators will be getting. And then the other is about what community-based testing accessibility. And Deputy Commissioner Mueller worked very closely with Susan Clammer from the Department of Health and the testing team, the testing work group. And so I would ask Deputy Commissioner Mueller if you want to address both pieces of that testing question, and then I can address any follow-up as well.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Dabney and Representative Edelson. So a couple of pieces. One, the reason that the New Jersey model was selected is because at this point in time, there isn't one locally that is prepared to be able to do it in the mass that we need them to be able to do it. It is a model that already exists, and we have worked with them on some previous things based on my understanding with health before. So the testing work group really felt like that was the very best place to be able to do that. It is really used more as a backstop. So if there is a positive test, the first recommendation would be that if you can get into your local health provider, that you would do that, that you would, and but if you're not able for some reason to get in more specifically around, like, as quickly as you'd like to be able to get into, you can use that test. Mm-hmm. And really it is more of a vial. So what would happen is I would go in and I would log in. My name is Heather, and I'd put in my information. They would send me what was assigned to me. I would provide my sample and then send it off courier and be able to kind of get that response within a 24 to 48 hour turnaround. And so that actually comes through in two ways. One, it's coming through insurance is helping to provide payment around that, no cost to the teacher outside of that. And then if there is an additional cost for first staff outside of that, then and it's all staff, not just teachers in the classroom, then it would be paid for then by a state with money that we would have had set aside to be able to cover those costs. The same thing then with the local health providers and thinking about what does that look like locally. That is the first step, is that just to really go to your local health provider. In that testing process, we did identify that if there are, I think it was roughly 50 plus cases, or if there are more cases and it's looking like they are coming from multiple places, then it would be possible that we would have a testing event in that particular community. And so that's where we have the testing event coordinators who have been redeployed from the Department of Education and are sitting on that work group and would be part of those regional support centers, so that we can really work to monitor what's happening in each of our regions and how we would be able to support school districts and charter schools.
Thank you very much, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Edelson, any follow-up?
You know, just one quick thank you, Chair. Commissioner Mueller, so the teacher then, if they need use one test, if they later need to go back, if there are any additional costs, then that will not fall to the teacher.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Yukim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few quick questions. One, originally going back to the data from the Department of Health and then zip code form, is there a way districts, I know it would be a lot more helpful to also have by age groups. I don't know how deep data can be disaggregated. I know some folks have been asking for that so they can make a little better scalpel-like decisions in school districts. And then also my second question would be, I know our school districts are working really hard to make it a safe environment for our students and staff, and we're kind of asking them to do a very large effort, sorry, and not enough coffee this morning. But is there a resource that teachers or our parents would have if they don't feel like the safety protocols in their districts are being followed, beyond just going to the school district that may not be following the safety protocols in the school board? Is there some place, like a point person at MDE or MDH, that will be readily available for them? I know you're doing a really good job on that forward-facing tools for parents and the public on the MDE website. I just was wondering about those safety protocols.
Ms. Ayersman, to the first question about data.
thank you, Chair Devine and Representative Yoakim. Yes, these individuals have reached out to everyone, and they've reached out to us multiple times as well, and we've reached back. But at any rate, the challenge with age specific data at the zip code level is the concern about identification. And so we're not sure that we're going to be able to do that, but we do have the zip code level data that they can access, and we're assessing whether or not we can safely, by data practices standards, disaggregate the other data.
Thank you very much. Assistant Commissioner Mueller, are you the best person for the second question about parent concerns on safety?
I'm happy to answer that question. Thank you.
Either one of us.
Okay.
Thank you.
So we have worked extensively with the Department of Labor and Industry to really come up with documentation and supports around how it is we'd be able to support educators and students, quite honestly, and staff if they feel as though that their building is not safe or that. So there is a process that has we've worked through with the Department of Labor and Industry. We have those resources available to us on the Department of Education's website, and I believe it will be also be available on the Department of Health site, because you never know exactly where people are going to look. And so we really want to make sure that we have consistent information that feeds into one spot, but you can be found in multiple places.
All right. Thank you. Representative Buking.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Daphne. Just quick question. You say resources online, but will it be very clear about who a staff member or parents could contact? Not just the research, just know what's supposed to be being done, but who they can contact if they don't feel like it's a safe environment.
Yes, there's a specific resource page that tells you who to contact and how to contact.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Bennett.
Hang on there. There we go. I got it. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for the commissioner, and this concerns transportation for non-public schools. We've had some issues, questions, and difficulties in my area where schools are operating on different schedules. Excuse me. For example, one of our districts isn't going to have elementary school on Fridays. Not because they have to, but because that's their choice right now. But our non-public schools, who pull kids from many districts, some of those that are going Monday through Friday. Sorry, I'm out of breath. I had to run outside with my puppy, and I brought my iPad out with me. So the non-public schools then are having issues getting students on Fridays. And so I'm wondering if you have any ideas on that issue, how we can maybe provide more flexibility. I know the funding actually comes from the state, so school districts shouldn't be out funding for this. And I don't want to have it cause extra weights on them. But at the same time, our non-public schools should have the right to hold classes Monday through Friday like the other schools around them are. And the governor's safe schools plans show that they can do that. So any thoughts on that?
Commissioner?
Yes, thank you, Representative, and thank you so much for asking. We actually just posted additional clarification for non-public transportation in our guidance documents. And because, first, identifying that statute requires that public school districts provide equal to and from transportation services for non-public school students.
I'm sorry, Commissioner?
In the district, and it provides for public school students. And so the guidance does address that the public school district, obviously in conjunction with health data, determining the instructional delivery model first, the in-person.
Are we losing the commissioner?
Commissioner, you seem to be cutting in and out quite a bit. Mr. Uni, can you help us out? Thank you for turning on your camera. Commissioner, we're going to ask Mr. Uni to respond. We're having significant technical difficulties with your feed right now. My apologies.
Yeah.
Mr. Uni? Thank you.
Representative Dabney, thank you, and representatives. I just wanted to chime in and say the commissioner is having some issues, technical difficulties, as we have some storms rolling through. I do believe Assistant Commissioner Corte can answer the question directly, but I just wanted to chime in and explain the technical difficulties. The
commissioner. I appreciate that. Commissioner Corte, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dabney and Representative Bennett. Yes, we did just put up guidance the other day. Statute requires that districts provide equitable services to non-public students in their district. So to the extent that a public school is offering in-person or hybrid instruction for some grade levels, the district is responsible by law for transporting non-public school students of the same grade levels. Now, that is not to say that they couldn't do more, and certainly I think there's situations where the public schools and the non-public schools have gotten together and come to some agreement on what that might look like. As you point out, they do receive funding for that, so we do encourage them to continue to make sure that they have that collaborative relationship between the publics in their district. The other option that's available out there is that the non-public school in the local district can agree that the non-public would contract with a private bus company for service, and in that case, the public school would pay the agreed-upon contract amount and then claim that expense and be reimbursed for it.
Mr. Chair?
Thank you very much. Representative Bennett,
yeah, thank quick follow-up. Yes, thank you. And I may ask more questions offline here, but I just make a couple comments. One of the components in that new memo that was released, which is causing part of the issue here, have changed it from schools being in session to only if they're in person that particular day. For example, when one district doesn't have in person on Fridays, then those non-public schools can't get transportation on Fridays. And hopefully we can give them more flexibility to maybe, like you say, work with those districts and also work with transportation companies on their own. I think we need to provide as much flexibility as we can, not only for our public schools, but our private schools and, you know, our non-public schools as well. Thank you.
Thank you. With that question, we want to transition to the funding portion of today's presentation. So Commissioner, if I know you're back on, maybe from a different number. So if you can walk through the COVID-related funding, let's test the technology.
I am unmuted. Representative Dabney, I believe.
You are. Welcome
Thank
back.
Thank you. All right. Well, I am sorry I can't see everyone now, but I have a hard copy of the PowerPoint in front of me. And so, Megan, if you would like to just go to slide 22, I can start there. And then I'll make sure that, and I believe we are stopping for questions at the end of this, or would you like just to go through both both sets of the funding presentation?
Why don't you cover both sections, and members with questions can hold until the end, please.
Sure thing. Absolutely. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. And you'll see on COVID-related funding, we start with just a reminder of knowledge you probably already have, that on March 27th, the CARES Act was passed, providing economic relief on both the public health and economic impact. The Coronavirus Relief Fund, which you will see referred to as CRF throughout this document and in discussion, there is a section that establishes $150 billion in payments to help navigate the impact of the COVID outbreak. And if you want to go to the next slide. CARES funding is coming to Minnesota for Education in five different ways. The governor's emergency education relief, and you'll see that is over $38 million. Elementary and secondary school emergency relief, which in those two things you will often hear them referred to as GEAR and ESSER by shorthand. Child nutrition grants to states, total over $160 million. Library grants to states, which is over $500,000, and Head Start and Early Head Start CARES funding, which is over $10 million. And in the next slide, the CARES money that has been prioritized, that foundation, as you can see, the foundation on meeting the health needs, the physical, mental, social, and emotional health needs, so that we can then better connect, more effectively connect to school, which is the next foundational need, and that is a physical connection, that digital connection, and those social emotional connections. And then that next layer and foundation of need are those effective learning opportunities as we increase that effectiveness for our students, particular attention to our students from historically underserved population, and then other local needs from there, but prioritizing those health needs, that connection to school, what we've heard is both devices and connectivity, as well as the mental health needs we have heard that we want to address and prioritize for our students, and then addressing the effectiveness of those learning opportunities. In the next slide, you'll see a breakdown of the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund, as well as the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund. For the Governor's Emergency Education Relief Fund, that $38.1 million is prioritized for that technology access. Again, those would be that connectivity and those devices. For our summer programming, recognizing that there is need for increased staffing or transportation, particularly for those schools attempting hybrid models, as well as a grant-based program for 0 to 8-year-olds to provide wraparound services, particularly focused on underserved communities. And then the $140.1 million for elementary and secondary school emergency relief, that 90% of that formula is going to keeping students healthy and connected to their learning. And then other local needs that have been identified through their own local surveying and determinations, and then also then state-directed grants to districts to supplement any of the governor's emergency relief fund priorities that still need funding and mental health support and targeted to historically underserved populations. The Child Nutrition State Grant, that allocation of $160+ million is additional funding to cover those reimbursable meal costs. We talked a lot about that dramatic shift our school systems made to provide meals to our students. These funds are used in the same manner as annual nutrition grants, and these do need to be spent before MDE's annual nutrition grant funds, and they can be drawn starting with March 2020 claims and going forward through this September of 2020. Next, you saw over $500,000 for library services and technology grants to states. This is to, as you can see, prevent, prepare for, and respond to COVID-19, including expanding digital network access, purchasing accessible devices, and providing technical support. All of you in all of your communities have very likely seen the really creative work our libraries are doing to support students and families and their communities in that connectivity. The allowable uses, really focused on these allowable uses to address digital inclusion and that technical support, as well as address efforts that help prepare, prevent, or respond to COVID-19. In addition to traditionally eligible library entities where appropriate, the 1 and 2 will reach also museum and tribal partners as possible. And then Head Start and Early Head Start, the purpose of Minnesota's over $10 million allocation is that these funds were made for one-time supplemental funding to existing Head Start grantees. And these can be used for supplemental summer programs and to repurpose funds for other one-time related activities related to COVID-19. And then, as you can see it by status, this number was arrived at by approximately $875 per child formula. And
at the end of June, our Head Start programs did receive notice of their funding, and so that allocation will go out across Minnesota. And so there's some work we'd like you to know around this funding that we've been doing to support our schools so far. First, we held our school finance division held webinar trainings for schools to help with the application process. We also have, of course, dedicated folks in all of our divisions to answer questions about these funding streams, to work alongside all of the applicants to make sure all the information got submitted and we properly, and then we started processing those applications at the beginning of this summer. We did make sure to let the applicants know that funds could be drawn back to March 13th and can be spent through this through September of 2022. And we do. We have been making sure to educate all applicants that the applications must be completed by May 1st of 2021, and that recipients will be able to amend their plan. And we will continue to communicate that, and we're dedicated to making sure the applicants are successful in their application process. And that brings us next to the Coronavirus Relief Fund request, as we said, also known as CRF. And I will pass it on to my partner, Deputy Commissioner Dr. Heather Mueller, to present this portion.
Thank you, Commissioner Ricker. So as we're thinking about their coronavirus relief funds, they're really the aid, the relief, and the economic security pass, right? When the CARES dollars were passed, it was also identified with over $2 trillion in federal economic relief to protect the American people from public health. And so in thinking about that, the Section 5001 also provided payments to state, local, and tribal governments that are navigating the impact of COVID. And the CARES Act sets criteria really for the expenses that must be met for the eligibility of those fundings. So when we were thinking about that, could you move the slide, please? Thank you. It specified that payments can be made from the CRF funds for expenditures that really result in public health emergencies, but costs that must not be accounted for in the current biennial budget. They also have to be expended by December 30th, which is different than our funds coming out of ESSER. And they cannot be used to fill behind lost revenues or pay for expenditures that will be reimbursed from another. Our total request, and again, I'd like to make it really upfront and clear about this, that this is still at this point in time a request. It has gone to the LAC. We know that that is being, we had our hearing, and we know that you all are walking through and thinking about that. And so I just want to be upfront that these dollars are not spent, that they are really still in the hands of this process. But in our request, we requested a total of $256 million. And that comes in the way of really three things. First, addressing the operating and the costs for our school districts and charter schools, as well as ensuring we're supporting our students, family, and educator needs at $244.8 million. The second is really supplies for schools and the flexibility for critical care supplies at $5.2 million. And the third of which is educator and school staff saliva testing, which goes to this is $6 million. So the first one is really in that $5.2 million as we're thinking about face coverings for every student, educator, and school staff. And we talked about that actually in the Safe Learning Plan up above. But we were really thoughtful in one of the things that we have heard consistently, and I'm sure you're hearing as well, is that our people who are coming back into the buildings are nervous. And we do have the executive order, which is very clear in indicating that in school buildings, if you are between a kindergarten and 12th grade, that you should be wearing some type of face covering. And with that, we thought about then how is it that we are able to distribute this? Because this is now becoming very similar to what we would expect students and staff to have in the way of having a pencil or a pen or having pieces that are really important. It's something that we wanted to make sure that every student, it was based on an equality equality piece. And so in our cross-agency efforts, we were able to procure one cloth face mask for every K-12 student in the state, public and private, as as well as a cloth face mask for every staff member who works in a school building. The second is that we were able to procure three disposable face masks per student, and that was really to ensure that we know there are going to be times when students forget them, quite honestly, and so do staff, and we don't want them forgetting a face mask to be a reason that they aren't coming into school or that they don't come into the building, and so we wanted to make sure that we had those available as well. The other thing we know is that we have students and staff who are deaf and hard of hearing, and we recognize that a cloth face mask is an inhibitor to being able to communicate clearly. And so we wanted to ensure that we also provided every single classroom teacher with a face shield so that their faces can be seen. And that is really appropriate for a couple of reasons, not only for the deaf or hard of hearing, but also for some of our youngest learners who are still learning and reading facial cues and social emotional learning. It's a really important component developmentally. We believe that's incredibly important. And so for every single classroom teacher, in addition to their one cloth face mask, they also are getting a clear face shield, as are 50% of our non-licensed staff throughout the state. Again, this is public and private, and that is because we know that a number of our non-licensed staffs also have the opportunity to work in some of our special education service programs. And so we want to ensure that they also have a clear face mask to be able to work on some of those social emotional pieces, social cues, as well as supporting our students who are and staff who are deaf or hard of hearing. Looking at the testing for educators and school staff, and I think this goes back to our conversation we had earlier, Representative, and just thinking about what does that testing look like. So that home test is available for every educator and school staff this fall at no cost. Again, that is public school and private school. And that means that if they were to take that test and there was a cost associated and their insurance did not cover it, that we would not only procure those tests, but also be able to cover those costs and backfills and backstop. We also appreciate that MDH has really given guidance with prioritizing testing for educators and school staff by healthcare providers and making that recommendation that if you are, they are contacted by somebody who works in a school, that they please bring them up on that list of being able to do that testing a little bit earlier. And also we have a process, like I spoke about earlier, where we are having coordinating efforts and how it is that we would do larger events if any school exposure was required. And we would have a team that would come in and do that. That would not fall on the shoulders of any of our school staff or our superintendents and charter school leaders, but instead would really be a joint effort across agencies throughout the state in coordination with the superintendent in a partnership with that superintendent or charter school leader, but really give us the opportunity to come in and then do that work with them. And then finally, we've really also set aside dollars for looking at the additional costs where we know that we have school districts and charter schools across the state who have not budgeted for this. This was not what they had thought about. We have operational costs where we think about cleaning supplies, where we think about some screening supplies, where we think about additional PPE for some of our staff members who are providing direct services to students receiving special education services. When we think about transportation costs and the increased transportation costs that would come with a hybrid model and having 50% of that bus full versus 100% full to capacity. And so really helping them to provide additional dollars there, looking at supporting student and family educator needs at $97.8 million. And we'll talk more about what that looks like, as well as administration costs coming from MDE and providing that support. And again, these are dollars are actually available from July 1st. Through December 30th. And again, they technically are not available now. It's still under the request, and I want to continue to be clear about that. If we could move, thank you. So when we think about the allocation of these dollars, the way that we recognize that and going back to that, the goals that were established early on in partnership with the governor's office and the Department of Health is really thinking about the first thing we need to ensure is the safety, health, and wellness of our students, staff, and families. And in the surveys that we did where we had over 130,000 responses from family members, in the feedback sessions that we did with our school districts and charter schools and with our families and communities, where we brought together with the Wisconsin-Minnesota Comprehensive Center over 150 people in feedback sessions to really give us some information. That was the number one thing that they actually said, is that they are very concerned about the operations. They're concerned about transportation costs. They're concerned about the ability to deep clean in the way that has been articulated by the CDC and the Department of Health. so that we can make sure that our surfaces are clean for our students and for our staff. And that was one of the inhibiting factors, that if they were thoughtful about how it is they would bring students back to school, the family's concern was if they aren't sure if it's not clean enough, that they don't know that they would let them come back in. So that was one piece where we heard loud and clear, those operational costs really were at the forefront of people's minds. We have to, in order to bring people back into the building, we need to be able to really work to guarantee some of those pieces. So in looking at the funds available, we looked at allocating roughly 60%, and that would be based on average daily membership. The next piece would be what looking at the 40% of supporting student, family, and educator needs, and that was the second part of what we heard. We know that we heard from our families and from our educators alike that we needed to make sure that we were providing support for mental health, providing support for any learning loss, and we'll talk about learning loss, and to also be thoughtful about how is it that we can provide professional development for our staff who have never taught an environment like this, and how can we continue to help to support them, and then ways that we'd be able to engage them as our family members, and how do we help to really reinforce some of those services. And so the way that we were able to pull that 40% together is really looking at the ways we also did some of our dollars around ESSER is really based 40% on average daily membership, and then 60% of those dollars would then be spent on allocated based on historically underserved populations served by each school or school district. And again, that's how in this they were initially allocated. But as school districts are getting these dollars, if they get these dollars, then they would be able to really look at any amounts. This is just how we were able to do the allocation. So we've already talked a little bit about what those costs would look like in ways that we would be able to provide some of those protective equipments and ensuring the operational components. And the next is really around the supports we have for the social, emotional, and support of our students. Can we skip, Megan? Thank you. So we've talked about things like also shoring up if the GEARS dollars and the ESSER dollars, you are not able to close that digital divide yet. This is a place to be able to do that. In addition to some of the supports around now that you have those devices in your hand, how can we support students and families in ensuring that they are good digital citizens and digitally safe? Supporting the tutors and mentors and to help address learning loss, looking at translation services, which was an issue for our school districts and charter schools before we went into a COVID-19, but became even more apparent as we walked in to COVID into this pandemic. And then also thinking again, first and foremost, about the mental health and supports of our students and ways to be able to provide expansive mental health for students who may have already had needed mental health and supports in schools, but now for students who have just started needing that because of the pandemic. And then finally, the administrative support is just really thinking about how it is we have the staff time to set up, review, monitor, and report on the use of the funds, supporting the SERVS application, which is used by the schools to draw and manage their funds, and then funding staff to help to assist school districts with the digital support and be able to monitor the use of their funds and to be able to build those reports and feedback, not only to the federal government, but also to MDE and our state legislators.
Thank you, Deputy.
The last thing. And the last
thank
thing.
Thank you. If you can just finish.
Timeline. Yes, I'm sorry. In the process timeline is the funds are available July 1st through December 30th, and we are being proactive in monitoring those balances so that way we can remind people that that those funds are coming to a close. It was submitted, like I said, to the LAC on the 4th. If approved, then the application would be loaded with the CRF allocations roughly on August 21st, and applications would be to be submitted by October 1st, and then we said we would be doing check-ins in October and again in November and reminding people of what that process would look like. The important thing to note is any unallocated funds by the middle of November, we would be reallocating them based on historically underserved populations and serving those districts that have used those dollars. And then the application is going to be very similar to what we did for the GEARS application.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. Members, Mr. Strom has provided runs for us, as we would expect in a finance committee. We are bumping up rather quickly to some limits that the good people at House Information, although they are being generous with their bandwidth. But Mr. Strom, could you Do you have comments on the runs that you've provided? And thank you for them.
Chair Dabney, committee members, there are two runs that are connected to the packet. The first of those is back from June. As the Department of Education has pointed out, and they've done great work in sharing data with us so that we can get that out to folks, the first set of funding was through the CARES Act, through the GEAR and ESSER funding. And this printout, which is both on the screen here on the committee website and then also in your packets, shows the amount of GEAR and ESSER funding that goes to each school district. As the Assistant Commissioner Mueller pointed out, most of the time this committee sees funds that are formula-driven, that are actually essentially an aid entitlement. Under the federal funding, districts need to go through that application process. MDE has been very helpful to districts on this, but districts essentially do need to apply for this funding, even though the funding will go out on a formula basis. But that's why the department's emphasizing the nature of the application. So the first round of funding, you can see on the printout here in about the middle column, totaled about $169 million to school districts. And this is presented in our usual form where it's a district by district list. You can see by region and then the individual districts listed for that initial allocation. And then, Mr. Chair and members, I know time is of the essence here. The second funding formula, which Ms. Mueller just mentioned, is the LAC request that came on August 4th. And as was stated, this is not final yet, but presuming the LAC approves the request, this distributes a total of $244.5 million to school districts. The Department of Education has been exceedingly helpful in providing data with us for us to put in the format that we usually use. As was stated, there are three pots of the funding, the CARES relief funding, operating funding, and then the two portions that are the families, educators, and student support funding. So you can see this printout set up in much the same way. You can see the in about the middle column there, that total funding is $244.5 million. And then you can see the per pupil amounts, which is based on the pupil counts that the department used for the formulas. So again, though, important to point out with this source of funding as well that districts must apply for it. It will come through their CERVS process, which essentially is different than the way that state aid entitlements go to school districts. And there are requirements about how that money gets spent and the timeframes for them to spend that money. MDE has done a great job of letting districts know about this, but those are different and things that schools need to keep in mind when compared to usual printouts that they see, which are allocating state funds.
Thank you very much, Mr. Strom. Members, we have very limited time, and we're bumping up shortly on the special session, of course. But Representative Kreisha, you had a question?
I don't see him on the interface any longer.
I'm sorry. Then Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
My question for the commissioner is, can any of these dollars be used to pay for unemployment insurance? Because districts are receiving some large bills, you know, for those they laid off who took advantage of unemployment. So will any of this apply, Commissioner Mueller?
Deputy Commissioner?
Sure, thank you very much. No, it does not apply based on the federal parameters at this point in time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Stendell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions from districts in my legislative district. One is the cost of childcare that they experienced last spring, which were very difficult to cover. And the other is, of course, the issue of kind of disengaged students. There were a large percentage of students in our districts that failed to log in or didn't continue their work throughout the year. Should these districts continue in distance learning until January, which is quite possible? They'll be out of school or away from in-classroom instruction for almost a year. And that raises significant questions of inequity and differentiation between kids who have done well and kids who traditionally haven't done well. I know those are huge questions, commissioners, but they certainly are issues that face all of us. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sandell. Does anyone from the department wish to respond?
Sure. I can respond, Chair Dabney. So thank you, Deputy Commissioner Sandell. And so I'll start, I think, with your second question first, and really looking at how it is we're going to support engagement. For the engagement pieces, I think that's really important is as we walked into the second phase of distance learning back in the spring, we worked at developing a model to really help to look at the differences between attendance questions and engagement questions, and really how is it that we can set up a system and structure stemming from our school districts to use our some of our support staff to really help to one, find where students are, right? The first thing we want to make sure is that they're safe and that they are well and that they don't need any additional help to know exactly where they are, and then to build those relationships to figure out why it is that they are not engaging and what's happening in those families. And so we did build, it's called the response to intervention model, that really helps to reinforce for our school districts how it is that they can build a system and structure around that and really break that down into what that looks like for days and absences, and really be thoughtful about if you're absent for 1 day or 2 days, this is the first point of outreach that we're going to make. If you're absent a third day, we might actually be asking to come out and do a home visit, right, from an educator perspective, and really doing some of those pieces, because we really are worried about our students. And that's one of the biggest concerns around distance learning, is not being able to see and engage with the faces of our students and our children. And so, right, sometimes even this, the ability to do that gives you the awareness of a physical and mental states of students. And so without that, that's where we really are trying to build those very specific and targeted areas of focus. And then your second question, can you reiterate that for the funding?
Sure. I have three districts in my legislative district, and each one had child care responsibilities last spring. And each one of them said that it was very difficult to maintain those responsibilities, and that community ed fees just didn't cover them. And so they found it very difficult to anticipate what those costs are going to be for the fall and how they're going to cover them.
Thank you for reiterating, Representative. And so a couple of things are different with our funding this time. First, there is the ability to charge before school and after school, which is different than what we were able to do in the spring. Although we are not charging for tier one, like critical care workers, for that type of care, we are also identified that those dollars that were set aside for operations can be used to help to support, right, the funding of that type of programming, because it is different and in addition to. And so that is another piece that we have been able to really articulate within that. And so that's where some of the differences lie between what we were able to do this year and what we were able to do in the spring.
Thank you very much. With that, members, I apologize. I know there are several others who have questions, but I'm trying to also manage the time. Commissioner, do you have any closing comments?
Yes, thank you, Representative Dabney. I really appreciate, I'll just open them by saying I appreciate Sarah Burt, technical assistance, to make sure I could be seen and heard with the little storm surge I think I had pass over. And I just want to make sure that if there are any questions you continue to have, please do not hesitate to reach out to us. I know we probably have some, if you have questions about the Safe Learning Plan, questions about the CARES Act dollars, we will make sure to get those answers to you. So if you like to either collect them and send them to us, or if you'd like to send them to us individually, please don't hesitate to do that. One of the things I will say is that our school partners in the field, our school leaders, our educators, have been incredible in sharing the information they are getting from the field. And we have committed to them to be equal partners in as we gather information, as we get evidence, as we learn more from the Department of Health, our agency partners, to share that with the field as well. And we want to make sure that we are sharing the information we are collecting as well, whether it is collecting some of those best practices from the field to Representative Sandel's last question about connection, which schools had the most success last spring, and what were those successful practices, and sharing them out, to the question about mobility and students, and how can we be the conduit to better communication if a student moves from one school system to another? How can we collect those best practices for distance learning from the charter schools or the district schools who had again found success in meeting the needs of students? To Representative Erickson's earlier point about collecting data on where our students are right now in their learning, where are they in that unfinished learning, and what are those practices we are learning about that we're collecting, what are we learning from the field. We absolutely want to walk alongside our school districts, be that supportive partner to them. We're really grateful for all the questions you have and your keen attention, both to the state of public education in Minnesota, as well as that acute attention you bring to your districts and charter schools in your district and the questions that come to us. And we are incredibly grateful to the Department of Health as well for being a partner like no other during this pandemic as we create the safest and healthiest learning conditions for our school communities. So thank you so much for your time this morning, and we look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you, Commissioner, very much. I want to extend a particular thank you to the numerous staff from both the Department of Education and the Department of Health who made themselves available and participated today. Generous use of your time. Members, thank you for joining us as well. I heard in the Commissioner's final comments there an invitation to follow up with the department, either of those departments. I think she was inviting for the Department of Health as well. Any questions you may have that you weren't able to get answered today, and I apologize to that. Members of the public who are joining us, thank you. I hope this was informative, and appreciate everyone's time. With that, we are adjourned.